761, People Against Lloyd. Are counsel here and in place for that case? Thank you. And we also have, starting at 2 o'clock, 2009 CA 1130, Condo versus Connors. And are the attorneys here for that case?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Have you all received our instructions regarding oral argument? Counsel in Condo and Connors as well?
Yes.
Do you have any questions? Everyone in the courtroom, please check your cell phones. Make sure they're turned off. And we'll proceed, People Against Lloyd.
May it please the court, my name is Kimberly Castor, attorney registration number 31606, and I represent the defendant appellant in this case, Mr. Isaac Lloyd. Your Honor, this case is an interesting case presented before this court because it is an example of how our trial courts are slowly slipping into a systematic denial of constitutional rights. While each one of these violations might individually be considered minor violations and not worthy of reversal, when this court looks at this case as a whole, it is clear that these multiple violations of the defendant's rights require reversal of the defendant's conviction. This is a unique opportunity for this court today to set down some controlling precedent in areas that haven't fully been resolved in the area of constitutional rights for a criminal defendant. And I would like the court to look at this case kind of in two different parts. First of all, the substantive trial that took place, and then second of all, the habitual criminal phase of the trial. Because they are both separate proceedings, constitutional rights apply to both of those proceedings, and so it's important to look at both of those as their own entity in terms of how they affected the constitutional rights of the defendant. First of all, I would like to address the motion for new trial that occurred shortly after the conviction of Mr. Lloyd. There is a little bit of debate, if you noticed in the briefs, over what standard of review should apply to all of these issues in this case. And while the initial decision for a court to grant a mistrial is an abuse of discretion issue, because it was litigated in a motion for mistrial, the court now has the opportunity to review it de novo and look at the applications of the facts to the law. And because each of these issues that we will be looking at today do allow for a de novo review, I implore the court to look at these cases, this entire case in its entirety, in terms of how it cumulatively impacted the defendant's constitutional rights. Also, just a kind of a side matter, I wanted to address the timeliness of the motion that was filed. It's unclear as to the court's decision, the trial court's decision below, what they were really ruling on. They just issued a one-sentence statement adopting the people's response. And in their response, they argued that it was not timely filed. However, if you look at the timeline that I set out in my brief, it's very clear that it was filed within the timely manner, and so it should be deemed timely. And if we assume that the court was ruling on that alone, that is plain error, abuse of discretion, and that decision should be reversed on that issue alone.
Counsel, when you say plain error, what does plain error have to do with the trial court itself? I mean, don't we sometimes apply plain error when an issue wasn't raised below, but does plain error have anything to do with the motion for new trial issue here?
If we want to, if you want to take it, I'm arguing it in the alternative.
I guess I don't understand.
Okay.
If you filed your motion for new trial and it was denied, then it's preserved. So what does plain error have to do with an issue that is preserved?
It doesn't, in the sense, unless we're just looking at the timeliness of the issue of timeliness. because that was something that was argued. Well, I guess it was preserved in the court below, so Your Honor, I will defer to to you on that one, that yes, it is, in fact, a preserved issue. So what I would just like the court to look at in this is that when we're evaluating a motion for a new trial, and it's a de novo review, and all we have is a one-sentence denial without a hearing before the trial court, it is a little difficult and dicey to determine exactly what the court was ruling on if we're just relying on the people's response. So let me address real briefly the substantive issue that was really kind of the crux of this issue, was the denial of the defendant to be able to cross-examine on a particular issue, specifically what happened in this case. There was an assault that occurred. There was only one eyewitness, which was the complaining victim in this case. The prosecution relied really only on that witness in their trial, and therefore the defendant needed every opportunity to cross-examine and question the defendant's, I mean, the witness's bias and prejudice and truthworthiness. And in this case, what happened was there was some kind of a exchange of drugs somewhere along the lines, and
That's alleged, right?
It's alleged. It is alleged, but that was the point, was that it was alleged, and the defendant wanted the ability to cross-examine the witness on that through bringing in some evidence to discredit the witness through another witness.
Pardon me for interrupting you, Ms. Custer, but why isn't this issue controlled by the division's decision in People v. Martinez, which the prosecution cites? I mean, Martinez basically recognizes that there is an issue here concerning the Sixth Amendment confrontation right of the defendant, but also the Fifth Amendment right to be free from compelled self-incrimination of the witness. And it sort of, quoting a federal case called Thornton, it sets out a procedure which courts should follow when you've got this sort of potential conflict. Why isn't that what happened here, and why isn't this simply a case where we refer to Martinez and resolve it that way?
Sure, Your Honor. And that was argued also, not only in the trial court, but in my briefs as well, that we believe that it was error to find that the defendant, I mean, to find that this particular witness would be open to prosecution based on just testifying in court as to whether or not she gave this victim drugs. We argue that there wasn't a corpus delicti, that it would have been just a mere admission in court, so it would have been just something.
If I may interrupt you again, please.
Sure.
As far as the corpus delicti issue is concerned, we don't know what the prosecution's case was. For example, theoretically, the victim of the assault here could have made a deal with the prosecution to testify, yeah, JR gave that stuff to me. Or there could have been other witnesses, or there could have been information we do not know. And because of all those possibilities, shouldn't we defer to the trial court in these circumstances? Because the trial court doesn't have the prosecution's whole file sitting on its desk in front of it, does it?
Right, and neither does the defendant, Your Honor. And so the point here is that the defendant is afforded constitutionally the right to confront these witnesses against him and figure out what's really going on here. And there was some inconsistencies in testimony and facts that were alleged, and so the defendant wanted to assert his constitutional right to confront these witnesses, and the trial court said no, and prevented the defendant from fully determining exactly where we were going with all of this. And then what was really tricky and what compounded this problem was the statements by the prosecution in their closing arguments, specifically referring back to this very piece of evidence that we weren't allowed to cross-examine on.
But
wasn't
your objection or trial counsel's objection to that sustained, and didn't the trial court tell the jury to disregard that comment?
Yes, Your Honor, but I think it is those kinds of rulings and those kinds of opportunities. First of all, I disagree with how the people characterize that scenario. The people alleged that the trial counsel was allowed to bring forth to the jury's attention that evidence existed and that they didn't hear it, but yet they speak out of both sides of their mouth and say, well, the jury's supposed to just follow the jury instructions and not consider those statements.
Well, let's say we agree with you that the prosecutor shouldn't have done this, that
sure.
It wasn't justified. why isn't it harmless because the court took immediate remedial measures?
Because I don't believe those remedial measures were sufficient. And when the prosecution is arguing out of both sides of their mouth there on that one, and the mere instruction, especially after there was a bench conference that specifically stated they weren't allowed to refer to this, they weren't allowed to talk about it, and then it was brought up again. So it's not like something, it was just like a little error or something. The prosecution actually took a step here, an affirmative step to bring up something that was specifically banned before and specifically discussed. So therefore, just a curative instruction isn't sufficient here and doesn't protect the defendant's constitutional rights when the defendant is relying on the rulings of the trial court. So it wasn't sufficient. And it's one of those situations as well where you can't unring the bell. And the jury's already heard this, and you know, it's the prosecution in the position of the government where they're always given a lot more credibility in front of the jury, and if they're bringing up these kinds of things that discredit the defendant, it's unfair. It's just, and to offer a simple standard curative instruction simply is not sufficient.
Ms. Castor, I want to understand your argument regarding the cross-examination better.
Okay.
And my help me along the lines of the inferences. If this woman had been required to testify mm-hmm. and to answer the question, your position is she would necessarily have said, I returned the drugs to him before he was assaulted?
No, it would have been after. The timeline was after, yeah.
And the inference to be drawn from that would have been what?
Well, I think it goes to his...
And I know that he testified contrary to that.
Right, so it goes to his ability to tell the truth. And as to what really happened, as to what really occurred in the case. So if he was lying about this particular aspect, why wouldn't he have been lying about other aspects of his testimony and how things actually occurred and played out? So it's one of those credibility issues, especially when it was these two people that were actually involved in the initial assault, which may have been over drugs. We don't really know what happened.
So let me understand. So the sole inference that would have been drawn from this was that Bynum had lied on the stand when he was asked a similar question, and because he lied on the stand on that question, then that brings into question his general veracity throughout his testimony.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right. Okay. There was no indication, no suggestion that you were seeking that he was actually under the influence of those drugs, and therefore his ability to observe and relate was impaired.
That could have been part of the argument as well. I think all of those inferences could have been made. That wasn't necessarily argued in the trial court as to the reason for it, but all of those things I think would have been reasonable inferences to when he got these drugs and when he's testifying, if he was even under the influence of trial. So
thank you. That answers my question.
Great. Thank you. Because I would really like to jump over to the habitual criminal phase, the Curtis advisement, because I think this is a really important thing. This is a de novo review again, and the lack of this Curtis advisement here is really critical. This is another separate adversarial proceeding where the Colorado Supreme Court in Moore versus People stated that habitual criminal proceedings are required to have the same constitutional and legal requirements as any other trial, any other substantive trial.
Pardon me, Ms. Castor, are you familiar with People versus Ziegler?
I am not, Your Honor.
In that case, our Supreme Court told us that there does not have to be a second Curtis advisement at an habitual criminal proceeding if there has been a first at the trial?
Yes, Your Honor. I have come across that.
Why doesn't Ziegler control here?
Well, I believe the fact scenario that the court relied on in those in that case and in those line of cases is the timeline, and that if we've just completed a substantive trial and we go immediately into a habitual criminal trial, you know, it's kind of all part of the one same process, and the courts are trying to assume that all these advisements in the first one automatically flow to the next one when it's something that occurs within the same day, even. However, our case is different and is factually distinguishable. Our trial ended, and then 174 days later is when they went to the habitual criminal hearing. So this, by very definition, appears to the defendant to be an entire new trial. And when this occurs, when there is this gap in time, I think it's unreasonable for the courts to expect that any advisement that a defendant has been given in any prior proceeding is going to apply to the next proceeding he happens to participate in, whether or not it's the same case number or not. I think it's really critical for the courts to not allow the degradation of these constitutional rights and advisements in habitual criminal cases. And if the Supreme Court is going to draw a bright line and say, we don't need to offer those kinds of advisements to defendants, we are eroding our constitutional rights, and I will argue that those are unconstitutional lines of cases.
Well, then your argument is with our Supreme Court, not with us, because we're bound by that authority.
But I think there's room to make a distinction here. And I think the distinction is that when there is a time gap, that there is an exception to that rule. I think this court could make that exception and find that, yes, the defendants are still entitled to a new advisement. We do that at sentencing as well, you know, where we re-advise the defendant and we re-ask all the same questions as to whether or not they're under the influence of medications and the entire list of voluntary stuff. We do it at pleas, we do it at sentencing. So why is the habitual criminal case trial any different? So that's what I'm going to stand on.
Thank you, Ms. Kasper.
Thank you so much.
Mr. Farrell?
May it please the court, Jonathan Farrow, registration number 35754, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. There has been no systematic denial of constitutional rights in this case. First, the trial court properly protected J.R.'s privilege against self-incrimination. J.R. had a reasonable fear of prosecution for distributing ecstasy. Defendant says that she could not be prosecuted without the ecstasy itself. The controlled substance is not the corpus delicti of distribution. It is the act of providing a controlled substance to another that is the corpus delicti of that offense.
But how do you prove that if you don't have the substance itself?
Well, in this particular case, we would have a confession from the actual defendant, and we may also have other evidence. There's a possibility that could be corroborated by any other evidence. It could be the eyewitness testimony of Mr. Bynum, as was mentioned by the court during its questions of counsel.
Let me ask a little question about the procedure here. So, I mean, I'm trying to understand who has the burden to do what when this kind of issue comes up in trial. The defendant says, I want to put on this witness, I want to ask him these questions. So what kind of a record should be made and who has the burden to make it? Obviously, you can't ask the witness these questions because that's letting the cat out of the bag, and she's waived her right to remain silent. But does the prosecution have any burden to say, well, you know, we've actually got the drugs or we've got a corroborating witness? How's the judge supposed to do that balancing?
Well, first of all, I don't believe that there's any basis for having a procedure where you would ask the witness, I mean, in camera or something. There never needs to be a record, is what I'm trying to say, on what the witness may or may not say. Once we have a statement that the witness would invoke their Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, then that's usually the end of that inquiry.
I agree.
Now, beyond that, to the next step of your question, I don't believe that the standards that we have from the Martinez case and then the federal cases that it relied on, and I also cited to the Supreme Court Steiner case, which is a civil case, but I think it's instructive on the particular question of the fear of prosecution. And that standard is very flexible. It's broad. It just requires a reasonable fear of prosecution. The only way that you can read that would be that the prosecution would not have to provide and lay out what their case would be in that particular situation. So it's left very open to the court to make a discretionary determination on that. I'd like to also add on this particular issue that, again today, the defendant hasn't really explained how impeaching Mr. Bynum would have actually changed things in this trial. How would that have revealed any bias, prejudice, or motive for testifying that he had? He already admitted in his direct examination, I believe, that he had a methamphetamine and ecstasy in his home the night of the assault, and that the assailants took it from him. So what would he gain by admitting that, but yet denying that he received ecstasy back from this J.R. at the McDonald's?
Well, that doesn't be a question for the jury. I mean, assuming this came in, I mean, unless you're saying it's, I mean, I know that you're saying it wasn't admissible, but or that she could be, she could refuse to answer. But if she answered and it came in, what you're arguing right now is a jury question, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It certainly is a jury question. However, I mean, what we're dealing with here is trying to decide what is an evidentiary hypothesis by which the defendant would have been prejudiced by not being able to essentially impeach Mr. Bynum. And we don't have one. The defendant hasn't provided one, and that's really the only point I'm trying to make on that. So really, we are totally speculating.
Any error was harmless.
Yes, absolutely. And I would like to briefly address the habitual criminal advisement issue. Judge Bernard, as you pointed out, no second Curtis advisement is necessary. You don't need to re-advise someone in the habitual criminal phase of their continuing right in that phase. They've already received a full and adequate Curtis advisement during the guilt phase of the trial, and that's sufficient. That's well decided in Colorado.
Well, let's take that a step further. Can you comment on Ms. Castor's argument that there's a factual distinction between Ziegler and other similar cases in this case, that here you've got this, I guess it's almost 6 months between the two trials.
Right.
Is there, within the Ziegler opinion, that kind of wiggle room or not?
As far as Ziegler in particular, I'm not sure. I thought that Ziegler had decided after the amendment to the habitual statute in 1996, where they removed the jury trial right from habitual phases. So if you think about it, before in 1995 or earlier, the way these things normally proceeded is that someone would, you'd have a bifurcated trial. The jury would find guilt or innocence on the charged crimes, and then they would then hear the habitual offenses and find on the habitual charges. But after that amendment in 96, it changed into the current scheme where these things are always, the habituals are always handled by a judge. So they very rarely, I can't think of a case where they come out immediately after, and we're dealing with right after the guilt phase, we go to the habitual phase. There's, you know, it's very common for them that, like in this case, to have a continuance. So with that said, if you look at some of these cases, the Romero case, for example, was decided in 1998. So that's going to, of course, in that case, there wasn't, I don't believe there was a delay in that case. If there was, I'm not sure exactly how long. I don't believe the opinion really makes that clear. And the Turley case was decided in 2001, but we're dealing with post-conviction claims, and you can't really tell from the opinion whether the habitual phase directly preceded or not. It's just somewhat unclear. And in the Ziegler case, I believe it was one of the more recent ones, but I'm not exactly sure on the sequencing. Now, with that said, is this a meaningful difference? I mean, yes, there is a factual distinction, perhaps. Is it meaningful? And I would argue, no, it's not. The Romero case, for example, stated that there's no basis for us to presume that a defendant would need to be reminded, that he would have forgotten his prior advisement. And whether it's 1 day, 10 days, or 170 days, I mean, what basis would there be to subsequently re-advise someone?
Did the defendant have counsel at the habitual criminal?
He did, yes, Your Honor.
Did counsel ask for a Curtis advisement?
No, Your Honor, she did not. I would also like to address one thing that was raised in the reply brief that hasn't been discussed yet today, and that is about the Naranjo case stating that failure to give a Curtis advisement is structural error. And I realize that this isn't necessary to decide this case. I believe there is a way the court could decide the case, as argued in the brief, that it would matter. But I just want to answer that in the reply brief, because Naranjo is wrongly decided. It should not be followed. Whether an error is structural depends upon whether the error infects the entire trial process, the structure in which the trial proceeds. The question is not whether the right at issue is fundamental. It's not the quality of the right. It's how the whether the right can be quantified or not, and its impact on the trial process. The Naranjo case misses that analysis. It focuses on the idea that the right to testify is so fundamental, it's a very important constitutional right, it's related to the right to present a defense, therefore it must be structural. The more recent cases, our Supreme Court have recognized that that's not the proper analysis. Instead, what makes an error structural is that you cannot assess the impact of that error because it affects the entire trial process. This is not an error that you cannot assess. I mean, there's been no allegation in this case that the defendant would have testified. There's been no allegation in this case that that testimony would have been meaningful in any way to denying the habitual charges. So, and what we're talking about here is not the error of a deprival of the right to testify. We're talking about perhaps an error that is not re-advising someone after they've already been advised of that right and waived it. So I believe that it is an error that can be assessed. It should be subject to harmless error analysis or plain error analysis in this case, since it's been forfeited. If the court has no further questions, the people respectfully ask that this court affirm Mr. Lloyd's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farrow. People against Lloyd now stand submitted, and we